Sunstone presents Women with the Priesthood, the RLDS Experience. Recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
Everybody here okay? I suppose that's making sense. If you couldn't hear, you would not ask the question. This is the session this morning dealing with women in the priesthood, the RLDS experience. And we will be addressing first myself, and then the two panelists will be addressing some questions that were given to us by the Sunstone staff concerning women in the priesthood. And then we'll open it up for questions, and hopefully we'll have time for as many of you who have any pressing questions to ask them. I'm Paul Edwards. I work with the RLDS Church. I'm the director of their Temple School, which is the institute program for the RLDS Church. Also serve as president of the High Priest Quorum, and it's, I suppose, in that capacity that I'll have some of the information I feel free to pass on to you in our conversations this morning. Our panelists are, first of all, on my immediate right, Mary Jane Carter from Pueblo, Colorado. Lists herself as wife, mother, and grandmother. Though I'm sure it's just barely a grandmother.
Thank you.
Well, being a grandfather, I know that it's not a matter of age. It's a matter of bad luck. Mary Jane is supervisor for the post office department in Colorado Springs. Was called to the office of elder in the RLDS Church in October of 1985 and ordained December the 1st, 1985. And when she will speak to us first. Next, on my far right and your left, Dana Cochran Wiley of Salt Lake City, graduate of Graceland College, served there as admissions counselor for some time, doing graduate work on her master's degree in social work, serves as a counselor for Youth Services Program and for Parents United, working with young incest victims. She was called to the Office of Teacher in July of 1985, and ordained in November 17th, 1985, which was the date of the initial ordination of women in the RLDS Church. Since the RLDS priesthood procedure is considerably different than I understand the LDS to be, let me make just a brief summary of how that is accomplished. The RLDS Church priesthood members are called by the pastor, which is the bishop. They are called on what is considered to be a divine-inspired message, the pastor recognizing both the potential abilities and the prepared abilities of an individual to serve in a particular office. They are called to that particular office. That calling is then discussed with the stake officers, our stakes being basically the same as yours, and if approved there, are sent for submission for approval by the congregations which compose the stake. So a member of the priesthood will be a member of the priesthood after a vote, majority vote, of the members of the stake or the district in which they will serve. It is the feeling of the RLDS Church that such priesthood calls need to represent both the congregation where the person will serve, but because they serve in a universal sense, that is, they can serve in that capacity anywhere in the church, they also need to be recognized by a wider constituency. This is true for all of the offices in the RLDS Church with the exception of high priest. High priest can be called by the general church and approved by the World Conference, which is done on occasion. But all other offices are called locally through the congregation, with the exception of high priest and, as some rare occasions, what we would call the evangelist. As far as I know, and I have pretty good information, women have been called into priesthood offices now all over what we call the domestic church. That means United States and Canada. In some areas of South America, calls have been issued, but as far as I know, no persons have been ordained. We have congregational units in Africa and in Japan and in Korea where calls have not yet been presented for what must be interpreted as local problems. That is, anybody who called them will get their head cut off. There are some cultural problems in some of those areas. Probably the strongest area where the cultural problem presides is in Independence, Missouri, about 20 miles from the headquarters of the church, where the strongest contingent of dissenters have gathered and where you would find the most opposition to the calling of women into the priesthood. I think in a very general sense, however, once the church began the process of recognizing such calls have existed in most of the major regions, districts, and stakes of the church, and in many cases, about 375 as of the moment have been ordained. There was a question of the acceptance of the policy, and I think that would require a lot of people a lot of time, but let me begin in a very general sense. They state that the official church has accepted the policy. That wasn't too hard to do. Once the document arrived and it was approved by the World Conference and considered the mind and will of God and placed in the RLDS Doctrine and Covenants, as section 156, it was not open for discussion as to whether or not the church accepted the ordination and service of women. What has been up for discussion and is considerably discussed is whether or not individual members will accept that decision. Such members have the opposition can do a variety of things. They can just not pay any attention to it. They cannot recognize it. They can refuse to be involved in it. And we have had members who have done all of those things. It's hard to tell how large a group is standing in opposition, but it is sufficient. It is not large enough that it is a danger or a threat to the establishment. It is not a challenge to the work that is being done by many women in the priesthood. But it is, in all seriousness, a strong area of contention. Some people feel strong enough about that they cannot remain inside the movement, and I suspect in the long run the LDS Church may gain some avid supporters in that process. On the other hand, there are some folks who are about ready to leave the movement because we weren't doing anything like it, and we have now saved them, and they have come back from your clutches. So I think in that sense, it probably has not made a lot of difference in terms of large numbers of people. The area in which I think the strongest opposition occurs are among those persons who feel that it is evidence that the church has lost the mainstream of Joseph Smith's thinking and of the thinking that was represented by the church in the 1830s. And for those persons, it is very hard to combat that, since they feel fairly strongly that this is true in almost everything else that the church does as well. So there seems to be a strong contingency of what we would term fundamentalists, who feel quite strongly that the church has lost the message of the Restoration, and this is but one more evidence of that. I suspect each of these two priesthood members could identify how they feel the policy has been accepted and probably would have a much clearer idea of that than I would. The question was asked if they are ordained to the regular priesthood or is there some special type of priesthood for them. I must admit that when this was first being discussed, one of my male colleagues, obviously male colleagues, suggested that we should create a new priesthood office called stewardess. Stewardess. Yeah. But fortunately, that didn't get any further than the room, even though I've heard him say it other places. But the answer to that, of course, is no. There are no special priesthood offices created. The call, if you will, was to recognize, in fact, what the document says is do not be surprised if. It doesn't say they should be or they would be. It just says don't be surprised if they are. And since nobody was going to be surprised, then the calls began to be issued. They are called to the priesthood offices as anyone else would be and as men have been for years. But they are, again, called to a specific office. And that specific office relates to what the church feels are potential talents or applied talents that they have. This is not, at least in theory, a hierarchical priesthood. Now, you all understand that theory, and we have problems with it not always being in theory correct. But it is not designed to be something you work your way up the ladder in. You are called to a specific office because of a specific kind of talent or personality. After having said that, of course, the most obvious violation of it as a theory is that no women has, as of yet, had been called to the office of high priest. The justification for that that I receive as president of the high priest quorum, I'm not making it, I'm getting it now, is that high priests are almost always persons who have served in another priesthood office for a while to learn certain kinds of ropes, unquote, and that in due time, once they have served their apprenticeship, women will be called to the high priesthood, which does suggest, of course, that it's a hierarchical priesthood series. But there are no stated restrictions against women being called into any office that is available in the RLDS priesthood. Again, they may wish to comment more fully on this.
Is there only one quorum for each office?
No, there's only one quorum for high priests. All the other offices have local quorums.
Am I getting this right that not all RLDS men are priesthood holders?
Right. There is, yeah. That you said it much clearer than I. There is no clear-cut time or circumstance in which an RLDS member is called to the priesthood. They are called individually by individual pastors at the time that pastor feels the call is there. Yes. You retain your original calling until you are, if you excuse the expression, recalled. That is until there is a call for another office.
Not a standard progression
of calling. No. It is even possible in theory, though I do not know of it existing in fact, that a person might serve a long time as an elder and then be called, say, to be a deacon. So there's no one level of direction on it. Yes, sir?
What percentage in a typical congregation of males would therefore hold the priesthood?
About 20%. Okay, one last point, and then I'll turn it over to Mary Jane. The question was asked, do I think the policy will be changed? No. The experience that I have had and the experience that I think the church has had in the last year has been so significant and so expanding and so personally rewarding, not only for women who have been called in the priesthood, but for those of us who have been in a position of working in congregations with them, that it would be almost, in my mind, almost an impossibility to suggest such a thing. I don't think any possibility in the world that this would be recalled. It would take not only an act of God, but probably an act of violence. Okay, Mary Jane, it's all yours.
First year of my marriage, I worked as a secretary, and then I settled into the traditional role of wife and mother. I washed clothes and dishes and sweet upturned faces. I bandaged knees and made the required amount of visits to emergency rooms at hospitals. And I rocked babies to sleep. I canned peaches and strawberry jam and baked apple pies. I was a Cub Scout mother, a Sunday school teacher, a Girl Scout leader, and I taught literally hundreds of children. And they, in turn, taught me about patience and long-suffering and love and tenderness and caring and brotherly kindness. If you think all of that was sweetness and light, I share with you that it was not. The summer my sweet 2-year-old turned 16 and got his driver's license, he had 2 automobile accidents in 1 week, one with each family car. I remember the morning he came home with my white Buick, and he said, Mom, I think you better come look at the car. And I said, Steve, what did you do? He said, I think you better come see the car. And I walked out, and down the side of my white Buick was a stripe of red paint. And it went through the back fender and the back door and the front fender. And I said, well, I guess I could live with a stripe of red paint down my white Buick. And he said, Mom, you haven't seen the Coca-Cola truck. And I said, Steve, what? Tell me about the Coca-Cola truck. And he said, well, the policeman who investigated said the damage was going to be at least $600. I share this with you because if I had any learning ground, any place that truly prepared me for those Christian virtues that the Lord says we all ought to have, those children taught me well. In the spring of 1984, I was elected as a delegate to World Conference. I went to that conference and sat in the auditorium and heard for the first time the reading of the document, which we now know as Section 156 in the Doctrine and Covenants. I was thrilled at that portion of the document, which had to do with the building of the temple. I grew up in a small congregation in Montana, and my mother shared with me her hopes that one day the temple in Independence would be built. I was glad that those women who felt they had a call to priesthood could now be ordained, but that was the extent of my involvement. And I turned to my friend and said, well, good, now those women who feel they have a call can be ordained. Other than that, I felt no involvement with that portion of the document. On the day the document was approved, it was a long and arduous session. Normally, the business session would end at about 4 o'clock. And at 4 o'clock, Brother Wallace Smith said, do you want to finish this or do you want to go ahead? And the conference voted to go ahead and finish the business at hand. The session ran until 5:45. And we dashed out to get some dinner and came back. And my husband said, would you just like to go on home now? And he said, it's been a really long day. And he said, maybe we just ought to go on home and not attend this next service. The service was already in progress. And I said, no, I think I'd really like to just slip into the back of the auditorium and sort out the things that have happened today. And that's what we did. We slipped into the back of the auditorium and sat in the back row under the balcony. And there I meditated on the happenings of that day, and I was so thrilled at having been a part of that historic moment. And I bowed my head, and in silence I said, Lord, thank you for allowing me to be a part of this historic occasion. And then I said, Lord, I would do anything for you. I would scrub the floors of the temple. I would wash the windows. And he said, would you be ordained? And I said, what? And he said, would you be ordained? I don't know how long I sat there before I finally said yes. I had just volunteered to do anything he called me to do, and now he was asking me to be ordained. I very smugly sat back in my seat and said, Lord, if this is what you're calling me to do, there ought to be some confirmation of office. I said, am I called to the office deacon? Nothing. Teacher? Nothing. Priest? Nothing. I went through every office in the priesthood and came out with nothing, and I went, what a relief that was. But I did not doubt the thing that had happened. I said, Lord, help me understand what's going on. I need some confirmation of the thing that has happened. And so I went back again and I said, Lord, I would do anything for you. I would scrub the floors. I would wash the windows. And once again, he said, would you be ordained? And the entire experience unfolded just as it had the first time. I came to realize that the Lord was not calling me to be something I was not. He was calling me to use those gifts and talents. He was calling me to be the person I already was, to minister in tenderness and lovingness and kindness and caring to all those people who needed ministry. That evening after I went home and went to bed, I said, Lord, forgive me, but I still need confirmation. And I went through the first portion of that experience, and once again it unfolded for me. I appreciate that experience because had I never been called, had the call never been approved by the district president, the regional administrator, the apostle in charge, the first presidency, the congregation in session, the district conference, had I never been called, I would still have that firm, sure knowledge that the Lord did call me. And had that happened, I simply would have waited and prayed for those persons that God's Holy Spirit would flood their lives with truth and light and understanding as he had flooded mine. I was ordained on December the 1st. That was Thanksgiving weekend. And we chose that day because my family would be able to come for the ordination. I was ordained with 3 other women and 1 man. And since that day, every day of my life has been filled with great joy. When I first learned of my call, I was literally on cloud 9. And I felt so good about everything that was happening. I was so excited and challenged. And the next day I said, Mary Jane, what on earth have you got yourself into? And I hit bottom. And the next day I was back up on cloud 9. And I went through that roller coaster kind of emotion until the day of my ordination. But I share with you again that every day since that day, I have been filled with very great joy. There have been some problems, too. There have been some frustrations. And my frustrations come in the form of a little boy who's 6 years old. Stuart was born with hairy brown moles all over his whole body. And those moles range in size from a tiny pinpoint to a silver dollar size to a grapefruit size to one that covers half of his upper torso. That dark brown mole runs from the middle of his chest all the way across to the back and up over his shoulder and down his arm as far as his wrist. The doctors are literally peeling that skin from him and replacing it with grafted skin from other parts of his body. My frustration is that I cannot lay my hands on him and see him instantly healed. A friend of mine saw him one time and she said, "What is the matter with that little boy?" And I explained to her about the fact that he had been born with this disease. And she said, "Why hasn't he been healed?" I said, "I don't know. I guess no one ever asked." That's my frustration, that no one has ever asked. My frustration comes in the form of Hiram, who's 9. Hiram was born with cataracts over both eyes. And he has had 3 separate surgeries to remove the cataracts and do lens implants. And Hiram is still blind. And Mark, who's 11. Mark suffers from von Recklinghausen's disease. His older sister died 2 years ago from the disease. His prognosis is that he will continually become more physically incapacitated, more mentally retarded. And my frustration is that, so far, I have not been able to help him. I have not found that climate that would allow me to lay my hands on Mark and pray that the Lord would heal him and make him whole. I've been asked how ordination has affected the relationship with my husband. I have to confess to you, number one, that my husband is the pastor and my call came through him. And had he not been able to handle this, the call never would have come. On a Sunday morning, we went to church and someone came to me and said, "Evelyn's in the hospital with a heart attack." And so I went to him and told him, and he didn't answer. And I said, "Aren't you going to go see her?" And he said, "Oh, I thought maybe I'd go this afternoon after we have dinner." I said, "I really think you better go now." Evelyn was 66 years old, and she's about 5 foot tall, and she's about 5 foot around. She's very heavy, and this heart attack was a very serious thing for her. And this was back in the late winter, I suppose. And he sort of looked around, and he said, "Well, I don't see any other elder here except for Jack, who's teaching a class." And then he said, "Oh, would you mind going with me?" And we went to the hospital. I did so with a lot of apprehension. We went to the hospital to call on her, and I wasn't sure the hospital would let me in. And I did not have a license that said I was an elder. But my husband went up to the desk, and he said, "We are Evelyn's ministers, and we've come to see her." And they said, "Oh, come right this way." And so we went down to Evelyn's room, and I had heard that Evelyn had problems with women in the priesthood. And I didn't know what kind of reception I was going to get. And so I took her hand and I said, "How are you feeling?" And she said, "Not very well." She told me afterwards that when she had come into the hospital, her pain was so great that they gave her 3 shots of morphine and it did not faze the pain. Her hand was cold and clammy. And then she smiled at me and she said, "Congratulations on your ordination." And I thought, "Oh, well, she's worked this thing out." And she turned to my husband and she said, "I'd like you to administer to me." And he said, "All right." He said, "Mary Jane will anoint and I will confirm." She told me afterwards she wasn't sure about that. She didn't know whether to say, "You know, I really don't believe in this," or whether to go ahead and let us do what he had said we would do. We went ahead and ministered to her. And she told me afterwards that when she had come into the hospital, the emergency room personnel said, "You have a history of heart problems, don't you?" And she said, "No, not that I know about." And they said, "You've had at least 2 heart attacks before this." And she said, "If I've had them, I don't know about them." And when the report came back from the lab, the doctor told her her lungs were clear and he saw nothing at all wrong with her heart. He said, "I don't know what you're doing in here." We have a cohesiveness, an atonement with each other that we never had before. I see that priesthood for me supports his, but his priesthood also supports mine. I've been asked how this has affected my relationship with my children. I was very pleased when, back in the 1st of January, my daughter-in-law asked me to administer to her. She was pregnant and was in her 9th month, and we were very pleased, my husband and I, to administer to her and to pray also for the health of the baby, that if any disease affected the baby, that the baby also would be healed. Next Sunday, we are going to bless him, my husband and I. He's going to be blessed by his grandfather and his grandmother. I went to conferences last year and was asked to serve communion. I think there were about 25 women who served communion. And in accordance with what Brother Edwards has said, we knew that there were people who would not accept this. And we were told that we were to offer communion to everyone. And if they refused, that was really their problem. And so we went with some strain and some apprehension. And as I moved down the aisle, I noticed a lady sitting over in the middle. And as I approached her, she put her hands over her face and just broke into tears. I thought, oh dear, what am I going to do now? And if it was going to upset her that much that I would serve her communion, I certainly didn't want to do that. And so I tried to get the eye of the man who was coming down from the other side of the aisle, and I couldn't. He would not look at me. And so I was told I was to offer communion to everyone, and I did. I leaned over and offered her the communion. And she grabbed my hand and hung on to it, and she said, oh, thank you. Thank you so much. People continually came to me during the conference and said, you serve me communion. I want you to know how much I appreciate what you're doing, how much I appreciate your willingness to be out there on the forefront. I felt a warm, loving acceptance through the entire conference. I have that in my congregation. I have that with the people I work with. The people in my office were thrilled for me that I was going to come to Salt Lake City, and they all wished me luck. I have three children, and when those three children were grown and gone from our home, we were adopted by a little Vietnamese girl. And I don't know where it came from, but when I got to work on Monday morning, there was an envelope on my desk, and it just had my name on it. I don't know whether she'd given it to someone else or how she got it there, but there was a note from her, and she said, I wish you luck. I appreciated that kind of thing. I see priesthood for women as being not so much a male versus female kind of role, but an opportunity for all to be called according to their gifts and talents, unique to their own personality. I believe that the Lord has bestowed upon me talents and abilities that are a gift from Him. And as I look back over my life, I see that He has provided me with the opportunity to develop those gifts and those talents and those abilities. I believe that God has invested in me and that He expects a return on that investment. Some of my gifts do not require priesthood for their utilization. I love to sing, and I certainly don't think I sing any better. I may sing louder, but I don't sing any better because I'm an elder. But some of those gifts are enhanced by priesthood and the opportunities that priesthood provides. I see ordination for women as a freeing of gifts and talents to be utilized in the manner designed by God. This is not a path that I chose to follow, but the Lord called, and I choose to follow Him.
I'm suffering from a sore throat and a cold, so please pardon me if I have to cough for maybe a minute in the middle of this somewhere. I was called to the office of teacher, and as I understand it, it is a much different calling than the LDS calling of teacher, so I thought it would be helpful if I shared with you the qualifications, specific duties, and various ministries the teacher may be requested to perform. The qualifications. Teachers are committed to Jesus Christ and the cause of God's kingdom. Priesthood members lead clean lives, free from all chemical dependence. They are honest, humble, clean, and neat in appearance, and walk uprightly before the Lord. Teachers are motivated by Christian values rather than worldly pursuits. They avoid immoral activity or entanglements. They respond affirmatively in their temporal stewardships. They are faithful in church attendance and in their priesthood duties, and they should continually seek to magnify their calling. Specific duties of this office. The teacher is the advocate of full participation, healthy relationships, and development of a healing, redeeming attitude among the saints. This is what it means for the teacher to watch over the church. The teacher is the attendance officer of the congregation. If members are not in attendance, the teacher contacts them promptly through visit, call, or on occasion a personal note. Participation is the key to right relationships in the congregation. If relationships are broken between families or members, the teacher will persist in either offering the ministry or making the ministry of the pastor or elders available to heal the relationships. If especially qualified in this field, the teacher may serve as the minister of reconciliation. The teacher is responsible for the membership records of the congregation. In this role, every person is known and encouraged to participate. The teacher, in concern for healthy relationships, provides home ministry to the lonely, the shut-ins, single-person households, as well as others who may be overlooked. The teacher promptly visits any newly transferred members and assists them to be introduced to congregational fellowship. The teacher serves as advocate for home ministry programs as a means of prompting understanding and participation in the congregation. The teacher is aware of community programs relevant to the needs of the saints, such as counseling services for families, individuals, AA, those kind of things. The teacher assists the saints in obtaining the needed community services. Some of the ministries the teacher may be requested or elected to perform might be serving as recorder of the congregation, assisting priests and elders, teaching classes on personal relationships, unity, peace, serving as a member or leader of a teacher's quorum, assist in cottage meetings, serve as lay counselor, work in community agencies providing help to the lonely and those needing help in interpersonal relationships, possibly provide friendly greeting at congregational meetings, and just overall participation in congregational meetings. So, in a nutshell, the teacher is one of a peacemaker, one of a reconciler. I'd like to share with you just a brief overlook of my history and how I came to be involved in ministry. Every Sunday, my family would attend the small RLDS church in Salina, Kansas. I remember when I was in grade school, I used to set the piano bench up that we had in our recreation room to make a pulpit. I would drape some towel or something over it and pretend that I was a preacher at church, and my mom would make my brother and sister sit on the couch while I read to them out of some book and pretended I was a preacher. My sister and I noticed early that only boys took up the offering. Well, we knew that you didn't have to be a priesthood member or a boy to take up the offering, but that was always the way it was. Well, she was always one that would put ideas into my head and sit back and watch me be the one, and sometimes that might be that I would get in trouble, but other times it would be good things. And so she talked me into asking the pastor if I could take up the offering. And so I did. And after a while, it was a normal thing for every other Sunday or so that they would ask me to help with the offering. And pretty soon that grew into saying prayers at church and different things. By the time I was in junior high and senior high, my sister and I would be planning services for the church, special Christmas services or different things that came up. We only had a few priesthood members in our church, and in Salina, because we were so small, women had always had a very active part, so I felt very nurtured in my congregation there to do whatever I wanted to do within my church family and never felt bound by my sex. I first thought about the idea of women in the priesthood my freshman year at Graceland College. I couldn't figure out why our church didn't have women in the priesthood. It disturbed me and was talked about often among my peers. I was a junior at Graceland College, and I went out on a date with a guy I thought I'd probably never go out again with. We were at a barn dance. Sitting on two bales of hay, watching everybody dance, he asked, "What do you think about women in the priesthood?" I kind of rolled my eyes and thought, Here's another one of those cocky priesthood members who's going to tell me how wrong I am to think that women should be in the priesthood. And I wasn't up for an argument, so I bounced it right back at him and said, well, what do you think? And he said, well, I'm getting really impatient waiting for women in the priesthood to come about. I literally took a double take at this fellow, and my opinion of him changed considerably. Well, we've now been married 3.5 years. He was thrilled with my calling and not really very surprised by it. Someone this summer asked me what I would do if Mike was called to be an appointee and to travel a lot. I smiled and said, it would be much more likely that Mike would be the one having to handle my being called to an appointee. When she talked to Mike, he agreed wholeheartedly. People have said how lucky I am to have a husband that is so supportive in my various non-traditional roles. And my comment is that Mike is lucky to be of that attitude, or I would never have gone out on that second date. My experience as a priesthood member in this church started out very uniquely. When Sid Troyer, my pastor, told me he had received a calling for me to be a teacher, my first thought was, wait a minute, I haven't heard of one other female priesthood calling. I'd always prayed that I could be in the forefront, but this was pretty intense. However, the shock wore away quickly as excitement filled my heart. My interaction among the congregation is a subtle one. I take an elderly person to the doctor. I inquire about someone who hasn't been to church and visit certain members who don't seem to have a lot of other support. My pastor has called me a few times when special situations come up, and because of my social work background, I've been helpful. We had one couple whose son was in jail and had a lot of disturbance around that, and I had some experience in the area, so I went and visited with them about their son's situation and how they were feeling about it. My pastor called me another time and said, I have a lady who just moved into the area. She hasn't been active in our church for a long time. She's just found out that her 14-year-old daughter molested her 5-year-old cousin, male cousin. And I don't know what to do. She wants a visit. And because I had experience in that area, then it was helpful for me to go with him on that visit. And so there have been some special ministries that I've been able to give within my calling that my education has been very helpful with. On August 10th, I preached my first sermon, and it went well. There has been no abrupt change in our congregation. Elsie Kornman, who was ordained the same time I was to elder, we have always been involved in the kinds of things that we've continued to be involved with our calling. One thing I noted was a new air of cohesiveness among the membership. People are realizing that we don't have to draw lines that say, you stay on your side and I'll stay on mine. We are all one in Christ. There is still a lot of work to be done. A lay minister usually has a family and a job that pulls from him or her ministry. Some priesthood members don't develop their skills and enter situations that require professional help. Our church has traditionally kept church leadership within priesthood, therefore not utilizing the talents of the membership. My personal soapbox is to be able to bring about the involvement of the members. A member can preach, visit the lonely, inactive, shut-ins, and sick. They can hold congregational leadership positions. There are only a few jobs that require a certain priesthood calling. Therefore, I see my calling as one of leadership. I am not better or more spiritual or more worthy or more dedicated than my sister or brother member. I do have leadership skills that are conducive to making things happen. I have chosen a career that will complement my ministry. This June, I will have completed my master's in social work at the U. Well, my future, it's kind of hard to say. I think someday I would like to be a pastor of a congregation. While Mike is working to keep us financially above water, I could put my energies into the congregation and my family. Only heaven knows what is in store for me, and I only pray that I can keep my mind and heart open to his will.
We have plenty of time for questions, if you have any. Yes, ma'am.
I don't really have a question. I have a comment. Several years ago, I wrote an article that was published in Dialogue about women in priesthood. And partly because I wrote the article, a lot of people have assumed that
Yes, sir.
Paul, Joseph Smith gave the Negro priesthood. And by 1849, Brigham Young changed the policy. It took us 130 years to change it back again. You, I believe, gave it to him in 1860-something. He tried desperately also to give a priesthood to the women at that time. I have a two-part question. How come it took you so long to give back the priesthood to the women? What do you foresee as the future of the LDS faith? I mean, it took you only 30 years to give the priesthood back to the Negroes, not 100 or so years to give it back to the women. I mean, we're into the next century, or several, maybe several hundred years before we give it back.
Well, I'm not sure I believe in linear progression. I hear a lot about that, but you know, when I was born, I weighed 11 pounds. And when I was 40 years old, I weighed 260 pounds. That means that when I'm 80 years old, I should weigh around 12,000 pounds. I've been fighting that ever since. I'm not winning, but I'm fighting it. So I'm not sure that linear progression of that would work, but I guess what I'm saying is I think that the RLDS Church, because of the way it is organized, I think as well as the kind of background it has now in the last 120 years, is more responsive to the thinking and feeling of its people, and thus it can make such a decision quicker now than it could have 50 or 100 years ago. And I suspect that that is going to progress to the point that our institution, as well as yours, will be more responsive, so there's going to be less time necessary in there to convince the institution what the people think they're ready for. I guess the question is, are the people ready for it? And you could answer that far better than I could. I think our people were ready for it.
Do you make the change as you look back at, say, the Nauvoo period, that you gave historical credence to it, where Joseph Smith was offering the priesthood?
I think we've given historical credence to it. I think it's been, you know, it's been a problem in our movement, primarily centered around, well, around the elitism of men who held the priesthood. I don't know any nice way to say it. That wasn't me, of course, I wasn't there, but everybody else. Yeah, gentleman in the back, and then Linda. General definition, I think, is at least in the RLDS Church, priesthood are called upon to take the mystery into the sacraments, to put the mystery into the sacraments. They're called upon to deal with the ordinary in the process of making that extraordinary for the people who celebrate the various functions of the church. So primarily priesthood in our church is directed toward the official duties of the sacrament and the unofficial duties as leaders and spokesmen for the church. Duties, as Dana indicated to you, are fairly well specialized. We recognize the deacon, for example, as primarily responsible for the physical comfort of the saints. And that goes from everything to, you know, keeping the church clean to being sure that, you know, people who are uncomfortable for any kind of reason will be taken care of. The teacher, is primarily responsible for reconciliation and for keeping persons happy with being in the church, in the congregation primarily, and serve as in the role as reconcilers. They are people who step in between arguing families, arguing priesthood, and so forth. We see the office of priest, primarily as a sacramental office. That is an office of ordinances, marriage and baptism. Primarily the serving of the sacrament, and it tends to be a family-oriented priesthood service. The friendly visitor, the home visitor, would be our priest. The elder tends to be an administrative officer whose primary responsibility is to lead or to direct groups of people, whether that would be in a congregation, a ward, as you'd call it, or whether that would be some kind of duty within the congregation. And these tend to be people who are a little more experienced, a little more mature, who have experience in leading groups or bodies. high priests in our organization are almost always called in the initial stage for administrative responsibility. These are people who speak for the church in a very official capacity as stake presidents and district presidents and regional presidents, who serve in the high quorums of the church and the presidency and the 12 and so forth.
I don't mean to ask a question, but is the priesthood a status or merely an office for a period of time for priests?
Well, the theory is, and as far as I know it's always practiced, is once you're called into priesthood office, you retain that office forever. What happens is that the RLDS Church makes a distinction between calling and ordination. The call, we believe, is initiated by God. It is made known to the pastor, to the bishop, the person who calls him. It is made known to the person who is involved in the call. And if those two people agree about that call and feel good about that call, then that is made to a particular office for a certain length of time. In the, you know, if you're called to be a deacon for a priest or whatever, you're called until you are called for some other responsibility or until death. And in a very basic sense, our more fundamental members would believe that continues forever. But you are set apart on occasion for different kind of responsibilities. A person may be ordained an elder and set apart as bishop for a congregation or a ward, or set apart to be, what are they set apart for? Bishop's agents or presidents of the deacons' quorums or something like that.
Pastors.
Obviously. Am I answering your question? Okay, I think Glenda was next. And then we'll...
I just wanted to make a comment. I remember when this first came before your conference and was voted on and so forth, one of the next issues that the Herald addressed several pages of questions that people had about the propriety of women, the historicity, the scriptural background and so forth for that. I don't remember the number of it. If any of you remember, it might be worthwhile to just say what that is, because the Herald is in the LDS Church Library, in the church office building, and historically in the library, and a lot of people are really interested in what some of those questions were and how they dealt with it. I thought they handled it beautifully, and it seemed like they addressed about every question you could possibly have about it.
That's the May of 1984. Okay. Yes, John,
Mike. Do you have a women's organization that would be a corollary to our society?
No. The question was, do we have an organization that would correlate to the Women's Relief Society? And the answer is no, we don't. We have had over the years women's departments. Either you want to speak to that?
Well, I think it varies in different congregations. I know our congregation, a little over a year ago, decided not to have a women's department anymore. Seemed like they primarily got together to make sure that there was food for the potlucks and got together to sew and all. I know there were some women that felt very left out at not being able to have this interaction anymore. But we decided, as the women that showed up to vote decided, that they wanted to incorporate their activities with other persons in the congregation that wanted to do the same things they did, which would be more inclusive with maybe the men in the congregation. So.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah,
I meant to say something about that. Dana mentioned appointees. That's the term we use to define the paid clergy.
What's the term?
Call them appointees. You're appointed to a particular position. That's a kind of a derogatory term, like going under appointment.
Oh.
You know, you just sort of sink beneath the waves.
So is the pastor's job just like a bishop for just a few years?
Yes. Yeah, pastors are usually appointed in the sense that they're either elected or assigned to a congregation for a year at a time.
Are they not for 1 year?
Yeah. And they can continue, but their assignment is for a year at a time.
So a woman can be a pastor.
Yeah.
Can they become?
Yes, sure.
We just had our congregational business meeting. Am I on? Our congregational business meeting, and in our congregation, the pastor is elected by a voice vote of the people. And there were two persons nominated for pastor, my husband and myself. And he was elected.
That's too bad.
That's for 1 year, and it's renewable 1 year at a time. Next year we'll have another business meeting, and once again we'll look at the persons available.
How long has he been a president?
I think about 7 years.
And that's not a big position?
No, it's not. No, he's the assistant finance director for the city of Pueblo. And his pastoral responsibilities are handled away from that 8-hour a day job.
So have you had any female pastors yet?
No.
Not yet.
I mean,
almost.
Nominated.
Yes, ma'am, over here next.
I wanted to say that I felt uplifted by the content and the spirit of your remarks, and I have two questions. One, to Mary Jane, was I was curious about the circumstances about those children that you left why it was. And the other question to Dana is your description of the teacher's job, I'll try to say this in a non-sexist way, sounds very much to me like women's work, and the work we have always done. And I'm wondering if there's going to be some tendency that women are going to be called teachers and bring some teachers as women.
Well, let's let them respond to that. When they're through, I'll make a comment as a pastor calling women.
Mary Jane said I could go first. I never thought about that in that way. When I read the qualifications and what the teacher's responsibilities were, all I thought of was this is absolutely perfect for me and my personality and the talents that I had naturally and the ones that I was developing. I also remarked to Mary Jane how there were few teachers in the history of, or in my personal history, that I only knew one, of one other teacher of the priesthood, so this wasn't a common call, and I'm not sure that if it's, you know, socialization of males and females, that typically the females have been nurtured to be the peacemakers and the reconcilers, whereas maybe the men haven't been socialized in that respect as much. So as far as socialization goes, that might be true, that there would be more women called, or that it might be a calling that we will find women called to. That helps. Mary Jane.
In the situation of the little boy that has the large hairy moles all over his body, his parents have never come. His parents have never requested that he be placed under the hands of an elder and be healed. And that's something I can't go up to them and say, let me administer to this little boy. Let me pray that the Lord will heal him. I don't know how healing works. I know that sometimes God heals and sometimes he doesn't. In the case of the little boy who has von Recklinghausen's disease, his sister died 2 years ago during surgery. And the parents were devastated. They're still heartbroken that they lost their oldest child. They had the elders come and administer to her every day. I don't know. I don't know how God's mind works. I know that sometimes healing occurs and sometimes it does not. I have administered to Mark on one occasion. Mark has so many problems. He has a withered arm and leg that he that's the result of meningitis he had when he was a baby. And I spoke with a patriarch and I said, do I have the audacity to pray that this child might be healed and made whole? I struggled with that for about 3 weeks. They had asked me about 3 weeks before. They said, on this date, will you administer to Mark? So do I have the audacity to pray that God will heal this child of all these problems he has? And I woke up on the day that I knew I was going to administer to him, and I was filled with such joy and peace, and I said, I cannot do less for Mark than I would do for anyone else. And I prayed that he might be healed and made whole. Someone told me that they had spent a visit with the family in a week or so after that. And she said to me, I just can't believe the improvement in Mark. He's like 1,000% better. Well, I rejoice in that, and I look forward to the day when he truly will be healed and made whole.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. Yes, you. Moi. Bon last.
My question is very personal.
Question was if we had felt an assuredness of the Spirit throughout, before and after our calling, would you say? I think that there's always periods where you have self-doubt and insecurities as to whether you can fulfill certain leadership positions. But I remember, even in my most rebellious times as a high school kid, how I always felt so affirmed at church and with my relationship with God. And I've always had this feeling that I wanted to serve, a very strong feeling. When Sid told me that I was called a teacher, it wasn't like Mary Jane. I knew I was going to be called a teacher, just waiting for the time to happen. It was more that I always knew that I was called to serve, to be in the forefront, to work for Christ. And that was some burning feeling that I had that I could never deny and that I had always pursued. And that it was within a priest didn't bother me. So I guess I felt like the priesthood calling would give me that little bit of clout that would help me to do my job better. And that's why my soapbox is to free the members, so that because as a member I did feel, not because of a woman, but as a member I did feel that oppression. And so that's, I'm glad that I have the priesthood to be able to help free members. Mary Jane, did you want to answer?
Following the time when I knew that I had received a call, I went home from that general conference. I told David this morning I bought this suit for my ordination. I also read my husband's priesthood manual behind his back. I couldn't let him see me doing this. After all, he was the pastor and responsible for the call. And I did those things necessary to prepare myself for that time when I would be called. I knew of a certainty, I knew of a surety that the call would come in God's own due time. When I was first spoken to about the call, as I said, I had some terrible doubts. It was not a doubt about the authenticity of the calling. It was rather being overwhelmed with the awesome responsibilities that this involved. And then, as I said, as I told you, I was ordained on December the 1st, and every day since that day I have been filled with assurance and great joy, and never in all of that time has there ever been any doubt or any wavering about my responsibilities and about the calling.
Okay. Yeah. I just want to say, there's something Elder Carter mentioned in her presentation. You know, both RLDS and LDS editions of the Doctrine and Covenants indicate that the rights of the priesthood are inseparably connected with the powers of heaven, and that the priesthood should be exercised in love, unfeigned gentleness and meekness, and kindness and humility. And it seems to me that women who are truly trying to be Christian women can develop that in their life, their normal, everyday life, far better than most of us men have even tried to develop the priesthood for years. And I really, really appreciate what you said today.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a real feeling that is coming up in me about the things that are being said, and I'm so impressed with all of this. I really want to know if you think that there is a connection between the fact that you have not had a relief society and that the women now have the priesthood. In other words, before women were given the priesthood, what was the primary women's leadership positions in the church? What kind of work did the women do? What kind of hours per week did women spend serving the members of the church in various ways that would be maybe aligned with what we do in Relief Society? What has the woman's role previously been in leadership in the church?
Ladies?
Well, the women's department is somewhat, that's what it was called. I'd say that would be somewhat equivalent to Relief Society in that they would meet once a week normally and would, it depended on the congregation. It might be a congregation where the women got together to sew or to have classes or lessons. Individual. I remember going with the women's department when I was a little girl to the nursing home. Every month they had adopted one nursing home, and I would go. And I think they would, depending on the group that you had, they would be as involved in community activities, involved in teaching Sunday school, and it was pretty individualistic. I think some women have probably been going with their husbands on priesthood visits for years and years and years, and others have not.
So there has not been an official outline for women's service to the church?
There's been a World Church Women's Leadership Commission. This was for years an unpaid position of
strictly a voluntary position, and from that group would come some kinds of workshops and study materials. But I think, in all honesty, in comparison with the Relief Society, it was almost non-existent. There was no central World Church program that women worked on consistently or directed, and as Dana suggested, was very often totally up to the congregation.
So now, what
Mary Jean may have...
What has been the role of women in your church, and what do they do in the church before this? Nothing.
Can I come in on that?
Yeah, you certainly can. Please do.
I was 16 when I first became a church school teacher. I had a class of preschoolers. And in the years ensuing, I have never, probably not more than for 3 months at a time, ever been without a church school class. I taught church school class. I was the choir director. One Sunday morning, I went to church, and I had charge of the worship service, and I had five things that I was responsible for, and someone came up to me and said, it's your responsibility to do the worship service next week, and I said, no, it's not. I've got five things this morning, and there are 100 people in this congregation who are looking for things to do. Go ask one of them. Never have I been without responsibility. I think there's as much responsibility and opportunity as anyone wants to take advantage of, woman or man or kid. I have to tell you about a little boy in our congregation. He's 8 years old, and every Sunday he takes up the offering. And when his mother was ordaining the deacon, he was so thrilled. He said, good, maybe now they'll be ordaining kids. He said, how old do I have to be before I can be ordained? One Sunday morning, my husband had gone around behind to meet with the priests before they came out, and he caught me in the hall, and he said, Don didn't leave anybody in charge. And I said, well, do you know what to do? And he said, yes. And I said, well, why don't you take charge then? He said, okay. And then he said, but I'm not old enough. And I said, John, do you know what to do? And he said, yes, I do. I said, can you get someone to help you? And he said, yeah, I can do that. I said, why don't you be in charge then? And he was. He's 8 years old. I see that God's call is to all of us. He calls us according to our talents and our gifts and our abilities, unique to our own personalities.
And like I had mentioned, in my congregation, you know, I was planning services in junior high, and they didn't, you know, they nurtured me in that way. When, after November 17th, there was a lot of media coverage. I walked in to my graduate class, and the teacher said, hey, let's spend the first 20 minutes asking Dana questions. And a good Mormon friend of mine asked the question, Dana, is it that women had a different role or an unequal role? Well, previous conversations with her, I knew that her feeling of her church was that the role she played wasn't an unequal role, but that it was just different. And I made the comment that any time someone tells me what my role is due to my genitals or what color I am, then that is not equality for me. And that is how I see it.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
How large is the RLDS community in Salt Lake, and how many women have been ordained to the priesthood, and how is it being accepted?
We have a small congregation in Holiday. I would say we have, maybe 150 on the rolls and 50, a different 50 every Sunday, but about 50 to 75 that are involved in our church. Elsie Kornman, who is about 55, 60 years old, was ordained to elder. And it has been accepted very well. It was a bit scary when Sid, the pastor, said to me as the day came for the congregation to vote as to whether they would accept the calls or not, he said, I want you to be prepared that they might not accept your call. And if the congregation, as a higher percentage, can't accept your call, then we would have to wait and call it again some other time, and that for the first time in the history of our congregation, we will have a ballot instead of a raise of hands. So, you know, there was some concern that the possibility that the congregation wasn't ready, they wouldn't accept it. But they did. We did have one fellow stand up to say, nothing against Dana or Elsie, but I don't believe that women should be in the priesthood. This person has remained active in the church, yet they don't attend the 11 o'clock service. They work in the nursery every Sunday, but they're there every Sunday. I had another woman who came up to me, gave me a big hug and said, you know, I don't believe that women should be in the priesthood, but I know that this is an important day for you, and I want you to know my prayers are with you. My grandparents wrote me a letter and said, even if you make the wrong decision to be ordained, we want you to know we love you anyway. And the only other experience, I've had four, the only other experience was when Mike and I went to Orem for a service, and he preached, and I was to give the offertory statement. And you don't have to be a priesthood member to give an offertory statement. You can be. You don't have to be a member of the church to do that. I gave the offertory statement, and two people abruptly stood up, looked at me, and walked out, and which was a definite message to me, and has happened after that to Elsie. But after church, they came up to me and made sure that I knew that they loved me. So even though those four instances of where people have sent me the message that, hey, women in the priesthood isn't cool with me, they have let me know that we love you anyway. Give me that support anyway.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to have some explanation and illumination on the type of priesthood that's there. Now, let me list three types and give you somewhat of a definition. We have a hierarchical form of priesthood, which governs church affairs and people in relationship. Then we're told by the scriptures there is a form that is maybe greater than that, or an advanced step called patriarchal form and matriarchal form. Now, I'd like to see. Have you explained to me where this fits? Because I understand that if we have a God in heaven, we have a good man, we have a mother in heaven, who exercises priesthood as, I believe, even though I'm not a member of the Orthodox Church, this lady has been called because she testified of her words of Christ to her. Christ is the one who calls, not man. And so, as an explanation to me, which is it? Is it in the hierarchical form? Is some of the priesthood forms you feel matriarchal, part of your very being as one of the heaven is revealed, or is it organization?
I think it's personal. I don't know if that answers your question. I know that when I think of God, I don't think of male or female, and it's easy for me to refer to God as He, because that is appropriate and coded. But I guess I see it as a personal thing. I don't think God looks at us and because of our genitals, decides what we need to do, but our soul, which is all of one with everyone else, so I don't know if that helps. But.
Are we getting to your question?
Well, the question was, is the priesthood form, as revealed in your section 156, more towards a matriarchal document, or is it hierarchical in origin?
It's hierarchical.
Hierarchy.
Yes, and part of the reason for that, of course, is that being RLDS, we don't have a mother in heaven. And that we don't have a mother in heaven. We're motherless in heaven. In heaven. And so we're kind of occupied and involved in a very hierarchical system. Interesting question you're asking. Yes, in the back, and then you next. We're getting to you.
I had two questions. One, Mary, the fact that you have not elected to offer
through the New Testament. In all those instances, it was not Jesus who went out and said, be healed, but these people who came to Jesus and said, you know, I have this problem. One of my favorite scriptures is the story of blind Bartimaeus who sat beside the road, and he heard Jesus was coming. And he called out to him, and everybody said, shh, be quiet, you're going to disturb everybody. And Jesus went over to him and said, what would you have me do? And Bartimaeus said, heal me of my blindness. He knew what he wanted. And that's one of the things I did with Mark's parents. I said, how do you want me to pray? What do you want me to ask for? I feel I don't have the right, really, to inflict my will on them, that they have a responsibility, too, in knowing what they want to ask God for. And in the case of blind Bartimaeus, Jesus said, your faith has made you whole. And blind Bartimaeus then followed after Jesus. And so in some instances, if I feel free to do that, I can go to the parents. I'm going to go to the parents when the time is right of Stuart Lee. I've known his father since he was a very tiny baby. And he was a child who was a hydrocephalic. And when he was 3 months old, his mother had taken him to the doctor and measured he had a cold, and he measured his chest, and he measured his head, and discovered that his head was larger than his chest. And he was placed in the hospital, and just 2 weeks before that, they had developed a type of surgery that would allow them to treat him. We came to a prayer service, and I remember at the time, we prayed for the healing of that little boy. I could tell you where in that prayer service he was healed. I could tell you exactly where it was no longer necessary to pray for his healing. The Lord had healed him. I need to sit down and talk with him about that. I'm not sure that that's ever been shared with him, and use that as a basis for bringing Stuart Lee to the Lord and ask for his healing.
When you made the question of my priesthood, I think it's more of a technicality of wording. When I refer to my personal priesthood, it would be within my priesthood calling within God's priesthood structure. So that reference is just in referring to my own personal calling, but not that it is my priesthood, but that it's God's priesthood. Just
sir, way in the back. Way in the back. Yeah.
Is it possible for a woman to be called in the office of apostle? And if it is, would you expect that to happen? And if you did expect it to happen, when would you expect it?
Are you familiar with the term when hell freezes over? No. Seriously. As far as I know, there would be no institutional reasons why that couldn't happen at any time when the prophet wishes to call such a person to the office. I don't anticipate it happening at least before April of 1988. I would not be unduly surprised if it happened then. We make our own vacancies. That is, people are released from our quorum of 12. And if you've got somebody you want to come in, you can always get somebody to go out. That is, he can, I can't. Yes, sir.
What about succession to the presidency, which has been typically patrilineal in succession? You have a woman lined up first for this succession.
Well, just for the record, I don't line those people up. But there are some groups within our church that make a point of drawing attention to the fact that President Smith, the existing president of the RLDS Church, has what, two daughters?
Mm-hmm.
No, two daughters, three daughters, and no sons. And that point has not been lost on anybody. What that means, I don't pretend to know, however.
Linda. To father,
yes.
That up.
All right, I need to clear it up. It does not have to go from it does not have to go from father to son in our church. Sometimes it goes from brother to brother. But there is nothing within the church structure which says it has to go from father to son, or that the person who assumes that position needs to be a member of the Smith family. It always has. But always has, may have come to an end. Fortunately, I will be long gone when that happens. It's probably where my father responded to this when my father's very old, 92 years old, and we had managed to get him to the conference session, the high priest session, where the document was read. And at the end of it, he wanted to leave. He said, I don't feel good, I want to leave. And so
we took him out, and after he'd calmed down a great deal, I asked him if this had upset him, and he said, yes. I said, didn't you think it was going to happen? He said, of course. I just hoped I'd be dead first. So you get all points of view. Yes, sir. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I forgot. Go ahead.
I have a couple of questions. One is, in your congregation, do you sustain or vote for somebody like the ladies? What's the age of that you can vote? And secondly, understand that some of your members of the Quorum of the Twelve or the Apostles, when they got released, they become patriarchs in your church. And I just wanted to make that, if that's true or false, I don't know, but I understood that it was, and therefore the following question is, what is a patriarch doing in the church?
I try to take those in order. In our congregations, you can vote on any church business, which includes ordination to the priesthood, if you are a member in good standing. The age requirement for being a member in good standing is 8 years of age. The good standing part's hard to define. So if you're eight, you can walk, and you haven't been thrown out, usually you can vote. It is true that members of the Quorum of 12, on occasion when released from the 12, will at that time or at some time in the future be called to the office of patriarch. In our church, the office of patriarch has retained a fairly essential position. My understanding is correct. The LDS have withdrawn the office of presiding patriarch anyway. Our presiding patriarch, who was a member of the First Presidency for years, operates as the leader of this quorum, and the quorum is usually identified, has traditionally been identified as the fathers to the church. I have a feeling that's going to be changed to fathers and mothers of the church. Many of the women I know who I think very definitely have priesthood calls to be evangelists, which is the other word we use for in the patriarch office. And I would hope that in the very near future, the kind of skills and abilities and feelings that they have will be used in this function. But patriarchs primarily are counselors, very strong parental figures, help persons, wise. Generally, we consider them old, even though they're not necessarily old. Old in the sense of worldly, having a lot of world information. The kind of people you can rely on for good, sound, solid, legitimate, divinely inspired advice.
But you get blessings in the future.
Yes. Yeah. Mary, do you want to say something? Okay. Yes.
Do you anticipate at this point in time what role a priesthood will play in the temple when you get one?
No. I'm not being cryptic. I don't know what it's going to be. As most of you are aware, the same document which made available women to the priesthood also indicated that the RLDS Church should be in preparation for the building of a temple in Independence, Missouri. This will be the first temple the RLDS Church has been involved in. I do not know of, nor would I have reason to know of, what they are going to be doing in that or if that sort of decision has been made. I know that the president, the prophet of the church, is very concerned about that. But nothing has come from him about what that will be. So I'm not avoiding you, I just don't know the answer to it.
You don't know the purpose.
I suppose the purpose of the temple is to carry out the function of God's plan for his people, but that's being coy. I don't know anything other than that. And if I did, I wouldn't tell you at the moment. Yes, and then Marine. Yes, sir.
Question for Elder Carter. Obviously, when you have this feeling of being called there at the General or the World Conference, you kept that to yourself. Did your husband ever speak to you prior to the official call he made to the state presidency, or did you share with him a little later before the call was made your feeling?
Not at all to both of those questions. I felt to have done so would have been to put undue pressure on him. Those things I shared with my daughter, and she never shared them with her father. I felt that he needed to be free to make judgment on his own ability, and so that was never shared with him in the time before he first spoke to me about the call.
And so the first you knew about it was when, perhaps, just before it was presented to the congregation?
That's true, and then he did not speak to me. I have a friend who was called to the office of priest, and her husband was the district president. And they got their heads together and decided that each of them ought to speak to the other's wives, that it would be an official thing rather than coming from a member of the family. And so the district president came to talk to me, and my husband went to talk to his wife.
So hard to be a man.
Shared with any other females and have ever got the picture that they have felt bad that they weren't called. I think at a women's retreat that I was at when the subject was brought up before any calls had been made, the general consensus was we would support women to be called to the priesthood, but to be the first is a whole different matter. And I think that a lot of folks saw the risk and the sacrifice that would come with being part of the first and not knowing whether they would be able to deal with it or willing to be able to do that. So what I've gotten from the women of my congregation, from my sister, from my relatives, is just an overjoy that it's happening. See, the calling of women has not only brought about that it's brought about a freeing of women in general, I think. And the boundaries are lifting for the membership, unordained ministry, whether they're men or women. And I think that's another real exciting thing that hand-in-hand has happened with the women's call.
The thing I found in my congregation is that women feel a lot freer to talk to me about a lot of things than they talk to a man about. In the months since my ordination, I've probably averaged one administration a week. Now, I don't think my congregation's any sicker than they were before, but they feel freer to come to me than they did to a man. We have a lady in our congregation who had a colostomy, and she said, you know, it's easy to talk to you about this, but I couldn't talk to a priesthood member. That would be so embarrassing. I shared this with my hairdresser, who is Catholic, and her response was, oh, I can understand that. I'd a whole lot rather talk to you than I would to my Catholic priest. And I thought that was a confirmation that was true in our entire congregation.
I think maybe we better cut it there. We're running to the end of our time. That may be a good place to draw it to a close. Thank you very much for joining us. We hope this has been informative to you.